This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 393 was produced on September 14th, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. Convexity maven Harley Bassman returns as this week's feature interview guest. Harley says, why take credit risk when the market is paying traders who understand convexity more handsomely? We'll also discuss inflation and the other usual macro suspects. And I'm pleased to finally announce the release of Energy Transition Crisis, my new docuseries explaining why climate change isn't even the best reason that we need to break our addiction to fossil fuels. You can watch it for free right now on YouTube or at energytransitioncrisis.org. There's also a link in your Research Roundup email. And I'd consider it a personal favor if you'd take a moment of your time to subscribe to the Energy Transition Crisis YouTube channel. Even if you're not a big YouTube watcher and don't even care about getting notified about future episodes, thousands of Macro Voices listeners subscribing to that YouTube channel will provide the kickstart needed to get YouTube's algorithms to promote Energy Transition Crisis to more users. I'll have more information for you about the project right after the feature interview with Harley Bassman. There's a good chance the Research Roundup email will be delayed this week until about 1 p.m. on Thursday afternoon Eastern Time. So please bear with us if the Research Roundup is a couple of hours behind the release of the podcast itself.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, September 13th, 2023. The S&P 500 December futures were up 103 basis points, closing at 45.17. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index down 9 basis points to 104.80, continuing to trade along its 2023 highs. The October WTI crude oil contract up 153 basis points, up to 88.52. Oil continues its bull advance. Eric and I will look at that chart in the post game, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The December gold contract down 57 basis points to 19.33. The price action continues to be sluggish on gold. Copper, flat on the week at 379, remains in the middle of its four-month trade range. Uranium up 163 basis points to 62.40, continues to trade at its 2023 high, with only its previous year 2022 high at $64 being the next overhead resistance. The 10-year Treasury yield down 3 basis points, closing at 4.25. It's still trading at its 2022 and 2023 high going into next week's FOMC. The key news to watch this week is the Empire State Manufacturing Index and the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment. Next week, we have the FOMC, Bank of England, and Bank of Japan monetary policy statements and the global manufacturing and services PMIs. This week's feature interview guest is Harley Bassman. Eric, why did we invite Harley back on the show as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, Harley is known in the industry as the convexity maven and has often advocated convexity-based trades as a way to gain edge over the market without having to make a directional call. So it's timely, since Harley thinks that's where the opportunities are in the market, to talk about his new ETF product, which I think is really newsworthy unto itself. Not so much Harley's product. Obviously, we'll give him a chance at the end of his interview to pitch his product. But what I think is interesting is they've changed the rules on ETFs so that managers can now start ETFs that use derivative instruments that they weren't allowed to use before. So it's really changing the landscape of what ETFs should do. We should probably do more coverage on that subject in a future interview. But that's not what this week's interview is about, although we will touch on it as we get to Harley's latest product at the end of the interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Harley Bassman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Harley Bassman, Managing Partner at Simplify Asset Management. Harley has prepared a slide deck to accompany this week's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not registered yet. Just go to macrovoices.com, click the red button above Harley's picture that says looking for the downloads. Harley, I've been really looking forward to this interview with you this week because so many people talking about the inverted yield curve and I don't know, the narratives and lore that go along with that. I'd like to push a little harder and drill down in this interview into, okay, inverted yield curve means what specifically? History tells us what about asset prices under what set of conditions? Does that make sense? Can we get into that in this week's interview?
Glad to be back. Wonderful to speak with you. Best podcast out there. And we can talk about that and a number of other ideas of how to go and make money off the curve inversion.
Well, let's hit it. We've got the slide deck. Where do we start?
Well, there's a lot of slides here, but don't worry. We're not going to touch all of them. Let's just start number one. Let me give some background first. Most of your guests go into detail on the economy. I'm not doing that. I'll just make the statement that we had too much debt, a debt crisis after the great financial crisis in 08, 09. And the Fed wanted to go and, you know, solve that problem. There's two ways out of that. You can grow your way out like we did after World War II, or you can inflate your way out. They can't make growth happen, so they chose inflation. So inflation was a feature, not a bug, and that was their goal, to try and create inflation to reduce the debt-to-GDP ratio. Now, most people will say this didn't work. I say, au contraire, it worked exactly as kind of planned. We did get inflation. We got inflation in assets, not wages. And that was the problem we've had for the last decade, which has contributed to so many problems. I would say many of our political problems also stem from this, you know, asset inflation where the rich get richer and the poor not so much, but we'll leave that for later. But we had an asset inflation of stocks, bonds, gold, art, everything. In the last round here, we finally got fiscal policy, so effectively a Milton Friedman money drop from the helicopter, and that gave people money, and they spent it. And we finally started to get some wage inflation, which was good. And that inflation fed through to the overall economy. And you had this increase in CPI, PCE, all the other various measures of inflation that we use, pick your poison. The Fed stepped on the brakes. And so that's slide number two. There's lots of ways to measure the Fed stepping on the brakes. I like this one, looking at this five-year forward rate. So kind of looking at the yield curve to create a rate in the future and compare that to where the Fed rate is. And you can see we've had the Fed rate touch this green line forward rate, we kind of go into a recession and the Fed drops their rate fairly quickly. We've just blown right through that now and we're still going. So the brakes are being applied. They're not working. Why is that? Okay, so that's slide number three. We have two things going on. You have a supply and demand issue. The supply issue is being flummoxed by boomers retiring early. That's slide three showing the predicted demographic. We know who's been born. This is no surprise. You could make these charts and you're kind of right because you can't go backwards in time. And people are retiring much faster. Why is that? Well, I would propose to you that the Fed's asset inflation in the prior decade. And who owns the assets? The boomers. They said, heck, man, you know, maybe I quit my job or stopped my job during the COVID. Why go back? Got plenty of assets here. I can retire early, right? Just go have fun. And so these well-experienced, productive boomers left the workforce. And on the other side of that, you have this millennial, page four and page five cohort. Millennials get married about 5 or 6 years later than the boomer cohort. And so they're hitting about age 31, 2, 3, 4 now, and they're having a baby. And when you have a baby, you got to go and buy a house, you got to buy a car, a baby carriage, diapers, all this stuff. So we have this demand coming from the millennials reaching that household formation age versus the supply constriction of the boomers retiring early, as well as, and this is very important, and do not troll me, please, page six, immigration. You could think what you like about immigration, but the reason why the U.S. has not had the same problem as Japan or Europe or someday, you know, China and Russia is we had immigration. When you total everything up, the economy is number of workers times number of hours times productivity. That's the economy. If you have net immigration of people working, you get more economy out of it. You can haggle out the taxes and the visas and this and that, but I will just tell you this, that if you choke off immigration, you have less economy. And how you solve that, I don't know. And those things combined have what's created this kind of inflation, in my view. So that's kind of where I stand on things. I do not think that you're going to see inflation dip down to the Fed's target of 2% anytime soon because of this combination of factors. The boomers are still going to retire. They have all the money. And the millennials are still going to have kids. And they're going to buy stuff.
Harley, I want to go back to page one and inflation, because I think this is such an incredibly important point. I've talked to so many really smart macro guys who are saying, look, the inflation was caused by the pandemic. It was supply chain issues. You know, it's all unwinding. It's going away. And what I just can't help but come back to is we've got this over-indebted situation that the Fed only has a couple of ways out of. And the reason that I have such a strong view towards secular inflation is not so much that I'm, you know, seeing data that I'm convinced that it's here, but that I can see that the Fed has no other choice. Am I missing anything, or is it as simple as the Fed has to figure out how to create inflation sooner or later because they have no other way to get out of this over indebtedness situation?
Well, first off, you and I are on the same page on inflation. There are others out there, some of who I'm very friendly with, who are my partners at Simplify, who disagree, and they're entitled to be wrong. The answer is this, I think, that do you want to get shot or stabbed? You have the Fed working on two ideas. One's inflation and the other is unemployment. Which button do you want to push on that? And I think the answer is supposed to be you want to go and if you're going to make a mistake, you push unemployment up to try and force inflation down. And the reason why is if you take unemployment from 3.5 to 4.1, something like that, you got X number of people hurt. But inflation hurts everybody. Well, not everybody, but the bottom quintile people, they're supported by public works safety net. Top quintile of people, they got all the money they need. They don't care. The middle 60% are taking it on the chin for inflation. So the question is, you know, if you're going to do public policy, someone's going to get hurt. You're supposed to go help the majority of the people. And inflation hitting this middle 60% is a bigger problem than taking unemployment up, you know, a few notches here. And so I think the Fed has to go and keep kind of cranking and stay cranked until they can get inflation under control. People will be hurt. Let's not fool around. But I mean, I think that's the choice they've made, and I think they're right.
Harley, let's move on to page 7, where you talk about bond investments, duration, credit, and convexity. What do those three things mean? Why do we care?
Well, now that we've pushed aside the notion of economics, which I don't care about, frankly, let's talk about where the rubber meets the road. You are basically, if you're a bond investor, you have three levers you could pull. Duration, credit, convexity. That's it. Duration is when you get your money back. So a 10-year is more risk, is more uncertainty than a 2-year. Credit, you know, you're buying a junk bond or IBM or Apple bonds. Convexity is how you get it back. That usually manifests as a callable security where there's an embedded option to it. And so in an ideal world, what the smart machine will do is say, okay, I'm building a bond portfolio and I want to allocate dollars to each of these three risks. And as one gets more advantageous than the other, I will move money around accordingly. And so we try to go and evaluate all these various risks. So let's look at duration. So chart 9, snapshot of the yield curve, it's inverted. What does inversion mean? It means that the shorter term rates, the 1 month, 1 year, 2 year rate is higher than the longer term rates, 10 year, 20 year, 30 year rate. Well, if the world says that, gee, in theory, I should get paid a higher yield for taking more risk, because a 30-year bond can move an awful lot more than a 2-year bond, given equal movements in interest rate, and I'm getting paid less for it? Ah, God, I'm not sure I like that a lot. And this notion that, there's no risk in duration. Well, that's totally bogus. You go look at page 10. This is a 30-year bond issued a few years ago. It's down almost 40%. We're talking like an equity-style loss on a U.S. Treasury. So, you know, can this bond come back? Can it do better? Can rates go down? Yeah, sure. But you're not being compensated for taking extra risk right now in duration. So I don't like that. Let's go to credit, page 5. We measure credit by saying I got a 5-year treasury, and then I slap on the odds I might get back 0 in 5 years because it might default. So IG is investment grade. That means triple B minus and above. That trades as a derivative, so you could easily measure it. So you take a basket of these investment grade credit bonds, and you can see right now it's trading around 65. That's about the forever average of credit. That's not bad. That's not good either. And looking forward to a possible recession and the fact that the Fed seems to want to jam us into a recession as a way to reduce demand, to reduce inflation. Like, I'm not sure I want to buy credit risk, take credit risk as my, you know, alpha, my added yield, when the Fed's kind of told me, hey, guys, we're going to go and cause a problem here in the near future. If I'm going to take credit risk, I want to get paid a lot more for it. And so I don't really care to be involved. It's not bad, but it's not that good. And page 12, same thing for junk bonds. We call them high yield now to be politically correct, kind of wokey in finance. It's trading at, you know, low 400s, 415, 420, 430, whatever it is. Once again, about average. I'm not getting paid more or less. And there's a great story that you're going to see high yield junk bonds hit the wall in the next year and a half because they borrowed money a year, 2, 3 years ago at very low rates. Most, you know, financings are 5-year credit. So starting a year and a half from now, they're going to roll their debt over at a much higher interest rate than they had. And that's probably going to cause a lot of problems. And so am I getting paid for that? No, I'm getting paid close to the average for that. So that's not that good either. So duration and credit, whatever. Page 13, MOVE Index, implied volatility. Implied volatility is the measure, is the cost of convexity, the cost of an option, the cost of unbalanced leverage. That's what it is. It's a measure of what you're getting paid or what you're receiving for taking convexity risk. And what does convexity mean? As a reminder, convexity just means you could make more than you lose or vice versa. So if you look at an investment or any kind of wager or bet or something, if you could, for equal up and down, equal changes, if you make 2 and lose 1, that's positive convexity. If you lose 3 and make 2, negative convexity. If you make 1, lose 1, 0 convexity. So the MOVE is kind of measuring the value, the cost of that. And you can see trading up at, you know, it's been in the 120s for quite a while. That is well above its long-term average. And so you're getting paid an awful lot right now to take convexity risk. And that's why I like that part of the risk world. That's the risk vector I want to move my money to, is to go sell the optionality. Now, usually I'm known as a long convexity guy, but as they say, no bad bonds, just bad prices. And with the MOVE up at this level, it's a better sell than a buy. And so that's where I want to look. Let's compare this to something else maybe. Slide 14. Everyone has seen this slide here. It's the MOVE versus the VIX. The MOVE is the VIX for bonds. Okay? It's a 1-month implied volatility on the Treasury market. And you can see how high it is. Why is it high? We could talk about that in a little bit. But certainly, you're getting paid handsomely to sell implied volatility in interest rates.
So what you're saying is that what the market is paying through the nose for is to essentially incite me to become an options market maker in fixed income markets, because options premia, for whatever reason, are being bid up very high if I am willing to take on optionality risk as a seller of optionality in this market.
What I'm saying is, if I have to go and take my $1 of investment and take credit risk, duration risk, or convexity risk. I want to go and take mostly convexity risk. That risk, the price of that risk has been expanded to the point where I can sell it and the odds are in my favor of winning.
Okay, now hang on a second, Harley, because you're known as the convexity maven, and a lot of this stuff is just second nature to you. For people who may not be completely familiar, the word convexity simply means a line is curved, not straight. There's a little more to it than that. So tell us, what is this convexity thing? Why is it so important? Why have you and your career become known as kind of the guy who's obsessed with it?
You know, there's no right or wrong answer to a lot of things. You got to kind of look at what the markets are doing and what they're offering to you and where you're being paid more for one risk versus another. Presently, you're being overpaid to take the uncertainty of when a bond will mature, or you're being paid more than the risk that a bond will default. So look at page 15. This is a comparison of implied volatility versus the spread of junk bonds. And you can see how they kind of go together. And usually what you will see is duration, credit, and convexity. Those three risk vectors tend to go, they travel with each other as they should, because in theory, if you have your three risk vectors, people will move money from one to the other and will keep them kind of in line. What you're seeing right here is that implied volatility, the measure, the cost of an interest rate option has been elevated. Yet you have not seen a similar elevation in credit. We could go into why that is, unclear, but it is a fact that interest rate volatility is elevated. You should see junk bond and credit spreads widening also to reflect that uncertainty. If we have so much uncertainty in the rate market, why doesn't that uncertainty bleed through to the credit markets? It should, and it's not. I'm not going to try and define why, but it is what it is, and I'm going to take advantage of it. Let's go look at page 16. So this is an interesting little toy here. This is a measure of a regular 30-year Fannie Mae mortgage bond. There's, you know, almost 7 trillion of these bonds out there, 30-year mortgages. It's the biggest asset class after treasuries. They're very liquid. They trade like water, and they tend to be measured as a spread over the 10-year rate. If you look at this right now at, like, you know, nearly 180 basis points over the 10-year, I mean, we've only hit this thing twice before, you know, once during the COVID panic and once during the GFC. We're at financial crisis spreads for a bond that cannot default. That's kind of crazy. And the reason why has to do with the embedded optionality in a mortgage. A mortgage bond is nothing more than a treasury buy right. You buy effectively a 10-year bond and you sell a 3-year call against it. That's not what it actually is, but you could model it up that way. And because the call option is so very richly valued, you create this huge spread. I think this is the best investment in the interest rate market right now. I think it's better than duration bets. It's better than credit bets by far. It's there for everyone to deal with right now.
And that bet is what specifically? The trade that you want to put on is what instruments?
I just want to go and buy near current coupon. So mortgage bonds, they're trading at a dollar price of 97.98, somewhere near 100. We'll get to this a little more in a second. But that's the idea, is I want to buy bonds trading near there. Now, the thing is, the bulk of the mortgage market, the mortgage index, is trading at an $85 price with a 3% coupon because everyone and their brother refinanced 2 years ago, right? Everyone took out these 2.5, 3% mortgages, and, you know, they refinanced and they put, and that's where most of the mortgage market is. We now have new bonds that have been created in the last 9 months. These bonds are very interesting because they have a 5.5% coupon to them. And we'll get to that in 1 second, but I want to go and dig into this forward rate concept. This is the meat of the story. This is going to hurt. Page 17, it's going to hurt. I'm sorry, but we got to do a little math over here. Some of you may have read the book Liar's Poker, the fun and games at Salomon Brothers in the early 80s, and all these guys having fun and making tons of dough. What they did was not rocket science. Well, I guess it was not rocket science. What happened is they figured out what a forward rate was before anybody else did. And they could figure it out because that's when the futures market started trading interest rates. Early 80s is when you started seeing bonds trade on the Chicago Futures Exchange, which basically laid bare forward pricing. And no one got it. The Solomon guys did. What's a forward price? Okay, simple terms. You or grandma, she can buy a one-year CD at 2% or a two-year CD at 3%. Which one should she do? Ah, wow, that's a hard question. Well, not really. If you buy the 2% CD for a year, as opposed to the 3% one for 2 years, to break even, that means the next year has to be 4%. So you get 2 for the first year, 4 for the second year, or 3% over the entire time. I'm ignoring the discounting and compounding, all that stuff. This is basic math. That's all it is. If I know the one-year rate and the two-year rate, I then know what the one-year rate, one-year forward has to be. It's just kind of one minus the other, and that's it. And we can do this across the entire yield curve. We can figure out what the 20-year rate 5 years forward should be. Or for my first slide, the 5-year rate 5 years forward, what that should be. That's very important because it basically is kind of teasing out information from the market. So if we go to slide 18, this right here is today's one-year rate and the one-year rate 1 year forward, the difference between the two. And what it's saying right now, and I ran this today, that spread is negative 108 basis points. 108. So specifically, the 1 year SOFR LIBOR rate, whatever we'll call it, is 542. The 2 year rate is 489, which means I take those two together and I could say 1 year from now to be indifferent between a 1 year today and then a 1 year next year versus a 2 year today, I have to get a 4.34 rate, down 108 basis points. Do I think that's going to happen? No. It's not going to happen. The Fed's not cutting rates anytime soon. But that's what the market's kind of pricing in. This is where everyone gets all hung up. What I would offer you is this. I don't think the market is actually saying the Fed's going to cut rates next year by 100 basis points. I think what it's saying is there's an 85, 90% chance rates stay here and a 10 to 15% chance that rates go to 1% because we go into some, you know, car crash and recession. That's what I think is happening here. It's a binary distribution of 90% we're here, and then 10% rates are down by 400 basis points. Which that will, you do the math, that'll give you this kind of number. So I think people are kind of not really looking into the shape of the yield curve and what it kind of means. I happen to disagree. I don't think we're going to crash and burn, so I'd rather have money in short term. But let's go a little more forward. You can go look at this in a bigger context, away from just the 1 year and the 2 year. Go to slide 19. This is the 10-year rate 3 years forward. The 10-year rate 3 years from now is supposed to be 25 basis points lower using, you know, market derivatives. Is that going to happen? I don't know. I don't care. What I do know is this. When you put together this sort of yield profile, the option market has to go make prices accordingly. The options market, the derivatives market, the financial markets, they price arbitrage free. That means you can't make free money. That means the price of gold in London and the price of gold in New York will always be within the cost to go ship the stuff across the ocean, right? If it doesn't, there's free money there. The price of oil here versus there, it's got to be somewhere within the bounds of insurance, transportation, storage. That's what these arbitrage-free conditions do. Right now, the current yield curve creates the notion that rates will be lower in the future, and this totally screws up the option market.
Harley, when I see a chart like I see on page 18 and 19, okay, we got something here that hasn't dipped below zero hardly ever since the early 90s, and all of a sudden it's going deeply negative. What that just makes me think is, okay, wait a minute, something has changed dramatically. I want to understand what that is and whether or not it's the same somethings that I already know about. So the somethings that I know about are the end of the 40-year bond bull market seems to have happened. I think we've got a secular reversal in interest rates. But as you've explained this, that doesn't seem to explain this particular indicator and why it's suddenly turning negative, because I don't think it's a reflection of a change in the secular direction of interest rates. What's going on that these two charts are different now than they've been in 30 years?
You know, that the question you brought up is interesting, and I'll push back by saying no. Forward rates are not per se a prediction. They are just the back end of an HP, 40. That's all it is. It's a calculation. I have a one-year rate and a two-year rate. I can create the forward one-year rate. Now, we tend to think, okay, if the yield curve is shaped in such a way that's implying a market consensus of a view, in this case here, the rates will be lower a year from now. But it's not a prediction. It's just a number that is arbitrage free, such that there's no free lunch for Wall Street people to make by buying and selling the 3-year rate and the 13-year rate in this case. It's just a number. Shorthand is it's a prediction, but it isn't. It's just a number, and you can trade that number whether you believe it or not. And in your case, you don't believe it, which is good because I don't either. So I can make some money on this if I don't believe that we're going to have a lot lower rates in the future. And when you have this sort of yield curve structure, certain securities, which have to also price arbitrage-free, so there's no free lunch, become very compelling. The reason why mortgage bonds are trading at 175 over treasuries, which is basically, a financial record away from the financial crisis, is because of the inverted curve. And if you think this curve is going to go and steepen out for a variety of reasons, you could make a lot of money owning mortgage bonds or callable munis. And let me show you how. Page 20. This is the last math. I apologize. It's the last time I have to do math. The blue lines here is, let's call it the current yield curve. Okay, I made it a few months ago, but it's good enough. It's saying a Fed fund rate of 5% and a 10-year rate of 3.5% and a little inversion in the back part of the market. And below that, I have a 10-year rate of 3.5% but a forward rate of 3.31%. It's 19 basis points below the current. If I go to the right and say, let's go and migrate to the forever Wall Street average. What's the forever average of Wall Street? Usually you see the Fed funds rate right on top of inflation. So let's call the Fed funds rate 2. You usually see the 2-year rate about 0.5% over the Fed funds rate. Okay, we're 2.5. You usually see the 10-year rate about 1% over the 2-year rate. That's 3.5. And then I put the back end, I flatten that out. So 10s bonds is flat. Just by doing that simple twist where I kept the 10-year unchanged, took the front end from 5 to 2 and the back end up a little bit, look at that 3-year into 10-year rate. It goes from 331 to 385. That is a very big deal, because if you go one more level down, if you look at this 3-year option, so 3-10-year, it means a 3-year option of the 10-year rate, it's presently worth about 6 points, 6.01. If I leave everything else unchanged and just twist the curve, that option value goes down by almost 2 points to 4. That's it. I didn't change the vol or anything else or credit. I just moved that curve, and that option moved by 35%. If a mortgage bond can be constructed as a buy right, where you buy a 10-year treasury and sell a 3-year call option on it. If you bought that mortgage, the treasury at 100 and sold the call for 6 points, well, then you've bought that package for 94. If that call option then goes to 4 points, that means that package goes from 94 to 96. You make 2 points on that package. That's what's going to happen in the next year and change. This curve's going to steepen out, and these mortgage bonds are going to go up by 2 points, and muni bonds are going to go up by 3 points without anything else happening. Just by the shape of the curve moving, the forward rate moving, and that embedded option going down in price. It's a lot to swallow, and you can see it on page 21, where I have this mortgage spread relative to the yield curve. You see how one follows the other. So if you want to go and bet that the yield curve is going to go and steepen, buying a mortgage bond is a pretty fancy way to do it. And if you can get a 5.5% yield on a basically government guaranteed security that's going to do better if the Fed pulls down that rate, this is a pretty good way to do it. I know it's a lot of math. I apologize. And you'll have to go through it a few times to understand this thing. But this is what's going on in the market right now. The Fed has created an amazing opportunity for you to make very solid investments. And the same thing happened in the muni bond market. Muni bonds are mostly callable. They have the same issue of a callable security where it's a 30-year bond, usually callable after 10 years. And that's that second one, right? With a 5-year to 20-year, that option's worth 10 points. It goes to being worth 7 and change points with the curve moving and just holding a 10-year point fixed, which is what I think is going to happen.
Harley, tell us about page 22. What's going on with the pink and green here?
Okay. I buried you in numbers. I know your eyes are rolling in your head. I apologize. Let's go back to nice, happy charts with happy colors. Page 22 is the mortgage spread. So the amount of money you get extra for owning a mortgage bond over a corporate bond. And as a reminder, why is a mortgage bond, why is it, it has no credit risk. Why does it trade at a yield spread over treasuries? Because that mortgage bond could be called in 2 years or could be called in 12 years. You don't know when you're getting your money back. That's the convexity risk. You're investing in a security that could be a 2-year or a 15-year, for God's sakes, and you don't know. In a credit, you're making the bet of I'm giving you money for 5 years, but I might not get it back, right? So I'm basically saying, what is the extra yield I get for a credit bond? What's the extra yield I get for a mortgage bond where I'm short that option? And you can see how they kind of go in line, don't they? As I said, you know, a while ago, you tend to see duration, credit, and convexity travel with each other. Please don't try to trade one versus the other. They move way too slowly with way too many lags to them. But we kind of look at a very long-term chart here. You can see how mortgages and corporate risk tend to go together. And all of a sudden, the mortgage risk is blown out versus the credit.
Is that COVID related? I ask that only because just looking at the chart, it seems like it's around the beginning of COVID that the divergence occurs here.
You saw both the green line and the pink line explode higher during COVID. And they both came down after COVID when the Fed cut rates, and started doing some more QE. But notice when they started to go and raise that short-term rate and invert the curve, that's when the pink line just keeps going up and the green line started coming down. Now, why the green line came down is kind of crazy. Because if you think about it, the Fed has said, we're going to slam on the brakes until someone crashes through the windshield to create a recession. Like, you'd think the corporate spread would be widening here. They're not. Don't care why. They're not. Mortgage spreads have widened because of the shape of the yield curve. And right now, you could pick up over 100 basis points more for taking convexity risk instead of credit risk. That's the story. This slide right here, that's the whole thing. This is the money shot.
Harley, I want to jump ahead to page 25 because this one is particularly near and dear to my heart. I've been reading a lot lately about S&P 500 hedges being the cheapest in decades. And I don't understand this because it seems to me like there's a lot of us who are concerned that this market feels kind of frothy. You'd think there'd be a lot of people buying hedges and they wouldn't be that cheap.
Well, this tends to be a a fancy Wall Street, I won't call it a trick, but a marketing tool to make people transact. So page 25 shows you the cost of an out-of-the-money put on the S&P. And the dollar price of this 5% out-of-the-money put seems to be, you know, as cheap as it's ever been. Page 24 is the math behind it. Save that for later. All that's happening here is this. The Fed took rates up. So a few years ago, we had the S&P 500 with a 2% dividend and maybe a 0.25% Fed funds rate. You can create a forward price off those two things. You can create a forward price off the... So back then, if the S&P was at 4,000, the futures contract would be trading at, you know, 4,350, be trading under because of the... You earn 2% on the SPOOs, but you only have to pay 0.25% on the rate. When you flip those two rates, so now you have a 2% yield, dividend yield on the on S&P, but the financing rate is now 5%, the futures contract actually goes above. So a 4,000, you know, futures spot price would be maybe a 4,100 futures price. And once again, it has to happen to make an arbitrage-free situation. Otherwise, Wall Street dealers or Citadel, Susquehanna will go out there and buy the S&P 500, buy or sell the futures, borrow the money, lock it up, and make free money. You can't have that. By inverting the yield curve, by putting the short-term Fed rate well above the dividend yield of the S&P, you've made the futures price go above the market price. And therefore, a put is now out of the money as far as the model is concerned. I'm not sure how else to go and dig into this thing. Page 24 shows you two screenshots of a put price from a couple of years ago and a put price now, both where they had about the same market price. But you can see in the very fine print there, that forward price went from being below the spot price to above. And so all you're seeing here really is the impact of the Fed changing rates. Yes, it does cost less. The actual put is a lower dollar price. So that is true. But it's not because of the market is less worried. It's not because vols are lower. It's strictly a function of the yield curve. And this over here is kind of the same idea that I had about mortgage bonds or callable corporates. When you invert that yield curve, you get some really kind of strange outputs into the market, and you are allowed to go and take advantage of that. And effectively, when you buy or sell some of these securities, what you're doing is you're investing money implicitly at 5.5% as opposed to 0.25%. And thus, the option or the security is cheaper.
Okay, Harley, I love the look of page 22, but tell me how I actually make money from this. How do I short the green line and long the pink line here? Or do I even want to do that? Am I looking for convergence between the two?
All you want to do is buy the pink line. Just put your money there. So here's the deal. If most people who, and almost all the products out there, ETF products or others, invest in the mortgage index. That's all the mortgage bonds that are out there. People like indices, and why not buy that? The problem is the bulk of the mortgage index is made up of bonds that were created, mortgages issued, 1, 2, 3 years ago. Those bonds had like a 3% average coupon. And they now, since rates are 5.5 for mortgage securities, they have a dollar price of 85. When you look at these mortgage bonds, they're kind of weird. A mortgage bond, you can kind of think of it, as I said before, like a buy right. So think of buying a mortgage bond at, you know, 98 or 95 and then selling a call struck at 103. That's kind of what a mortgage looks like, is a buy right where you buy the bond at 100 and you sell the call at 103. Because once you get 50, 60, 80 basis points lower in rate, people will refinance and your bond will be called from you. Why would you want to buy a bond struck at 85 and sell a call at 103? You're 250 basis points away. You're selling a call for pennies. It's not even worth it. And that's what you're getting when you buy the mortgage index. And you can see on page 23, I've modeled this thing up, and it's a very long, it's like a 10-year duration security, and it only yields 60 basis points above treasuries. And that's a good yield, but you know, whatever. If you buy a newly issued mortgage that's been created in the last year, it'll have a dollar price of about 98, a coupon of 5.5, a distribution yield of 5.6 versus the mortgage index of 3.5, and a duration of 4 as opposed to 7. That's because the bond might get called. It's priced at 98. The call is at 103. It might get called. That picks up 200 basis points in coupon and 100 basis points in yield to maturity. That's what I want to do. I want to go and buy these newly issued mortgage bonds at 98. Problem is, it's very hard to do that as a civilian. Very hard to do that as a civilian. So what I'm doing is creating a product, a strategy that will only contain newly issued mortgage bonds priced around 97, 98, having a coupon of around 5.5.
Now, hang on, sanity check. Is that the pink line on page 22?
Yep.
Okay, so you are creating an ETF that will allow me to buy the pink line on page 22.
That's correct.
And it is not a, it's not X the green line or anything. It's just the pink line.
It's just the pink line. So you will get, it'll have a distribution yield of about, you know, 5.3, 5.4, somewhere in there. And it'll trade like a five-year treasury. The duration of a five-year treasury, so it's a little shorter, and of the yield to maturity, you know, around 585, so 100 basis points more than the index. We're creating a strategy that can buy the pink line, because you don't really want to buy the mortgage index. When you buy the mortgage index, it's like a 10-year treasury. Like, why are you doing that? If you are that bullish on interest rates, just buy the 10-year, man. You want to make something, you want to buy something that's going to move a lot if rates go down a lot. You don't want to do a buy right if you think prices are going to go up a lot. I think, as I said before, what you're going to see is a curve rotation where that front end goes from 5 and change to 2 and change, and the 10-year stays around 3.5. And if that happens, you're going to see, shockingly, you're going to see that newly issued MBS go up in price and the mortgage index go down in price. So it's a very clever way to kind of grab that embedded option and sell it and have no credit risk. It's basically full faith and credit of the U.S. It's kind of like a 10-year treasury and a 3-year call option sold against it with the move up at like 120. Kind of doesn't get better than that. And why no one's done this before, truth be told, I have no idea. But like most things in the world, I mean, like Post-it notes. I mean, a darn good idea. Why weren't they invented 30 years ago? They should have been. Most good ideas kind of come out of nowhere. I'm surprised this hasn't been done yet. And everyone's asking me all the time, because I've been writing about mortgages for quite a while now, how do I go and buy that pink line? Well, I couldn't find a way to do it, so I made it up.
Well, Harley, I have to break the news to you that Post-it notes are more than 30 years old now, and as are we. But I'm not going to say by how much. I'm going to leave that one alone. Before I let you go, though, tell us a little bit more. It sounds like you've just added a new ETF to the cadre at Simplify. For any of our listeners who aren't familiar with what you do at Simplify Asset Management, what's the story there, and what is this new product you're talking about, something that's actually launched? Is there a ticker symbol for it? What's the story?
I can't talk tickers, Eric. And this, let's call this a strategy for now. But yes, there will be something to trade in the relatively near future. Simplify Asset Management is just very clever. What happened was, 3, 4, 5 years ago, there was a change in regulation at the SEC that allowed us people to put derivatives, futures, options, total return swaps, all these various, professional investment tools to put them into ETFs. That's what was new. The rules changed. Our firm is 2 and change years old. We have $2.5 billion. We're one of the fastest growing ETF issuer managers out there because what we're doing is using derivatives into ETFs to give you a better profile. There's a lot of products we have that are identical to ordinary indices, but by using derivatives as opposed to buying the actual cash investment, we can offer a higher yield with no more added risk. Because the professionals, there's lots of tools in there that allow you to be kind of clever without taking on a lot more risk. And that's what we do. You know, my strategy that we created a couple of years ago, the 7-year put option on the 30-year treasury, that was the number one return ETF last year, up 92%. It's up 14% right now, year to date. And that's still a clever idea. Where else can you buy a 7-year put option on a 30-year treasury for civilians listed on all the exchanges? You could trade them on Robinhood if you want. And that's what we do. And we found a number of ways to create interesting products where we take professional investment tools and offer them to civilians via the ETF framework. It's shockingly simple, and I'm glad I'm there because it's a hand-in-glove fit for me because, you know, I'm a Wall Street derivatives guy.
And you can find out more information at simplify.us. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com. My new free documentary series, Energy Transition Crisis, is live on YouTube. You can watch all 8 episodes for free at energytransitioncrisis.org and on the Energy Transition Crisis YouTube channel. Macro Voices has been commercial-free since July 1st, thanks to donations covering our production budget. We don't normally ask for anything in return for bringing you Macro Voices for free every week, but I'd consider it a personal favor if everyone listening could take just a minute to subscribe to the Energy Transition Crisis YouTube channel and like all the episodes. Even if you're not going to watch the series yourself, that one act will make a profound difference in how many people this message reaches, because YouTube's trending algorithms are all about the momentum of likes, subscriptions, and most importantly, viewer comments. If you're inspired by the message of this docuseries, please engage with other viewers in the YouTube comments. And if you really want to help, there's even a donations page at energytransitioncrisis.org where you can make a donation to help promote Energy Transition Crisis through YouTube and social media advertising. This is a passion project for me, and I have no profit motive. I just want the millions of young people around the world who've become passionate about climate change to understand how badly they've been lied to and how little progress has really been made on energy transition. So if you've enjoyed this free podcast for the last 7 years, I'd really appreciate the personal favor of your help making the launch of Energy Transition Crisis a success. The more help we can get promoting Energy Transition Crisis on social media, adding subscribers and comments to the Energy Transition Crisis YouTube channel, and requesting me as a guest on big audience podcasts like Joe Rogan, the better. Now let's get back to the show and Patrick's postgame chart deck.
Now back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Harley Bassman back on the show. I want to talk about some of the things he said in a moment, but Nick Alarnik remains on vacation. So Eric, let's just talk some charts. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Now just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Harley's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a build of 4 million barrels. That was against consensus expectations of a drawdown of about 2 million barrels. So much, much bigger build than expected. Cushing, Oklahoma was the drawdown on the board, and it was a big one, drawing down 2.5 million barrels. That's really significant because Cushing is a physical hub where a lot of oil gets routed through. It's not just a statistic, it's a physical place, and if they run out of oil there, it really presents a problem. So we're going to have to keep an eye on that one. Gasoline and distillates, both great big builds this week. 5.6 million barrels on gasoline, 2.6 million barrels on distillates. Those were both quite a bit bigger than expected. U.S. production ticking up another 100,000 barrels to 12.9 million barrels. I really want to salute our listeners who are in the oil patch around the globe, both in the U.S. and elsewhere, for just amazing post-COVID recovery of this industry. So many experts told us there's no way we would ever get back to anything close to 13 million barrels. We're not there quite yet, but boy, we're just within a stone's throw of it, and I think we're going to get there. It's going to be very interesting to see if we can break to an all-time high and where that takes us from here. So congratulations to the U.S. oil patch for really pulling off a phenomenal job here. The biggest news, though, this week is EIA confirming OPEC Plus projections for a demand shortfall in the second half. I think I heard that on a podcast about a year ago that was coming. So between a much more bearish inventory than expected and overbought conditions to start with in this market, needless to say, a pullback of some kind is overdue and very much in order. But so far, the lesson of recent history in this market has been that pullbacks in oil have been shallower and shorter lived than most people, including myself, have expected. So how much of a pullback we get, I don't know. Hopefully we can at least get back down to the 5 and 8 day moving averages, which are just below the market. I'd love to see a deeper pullback so that I can add more to my position, but I still think that we've got quite a bit further to go. This is the supply shortfall, the supply tightness that I have been predicting, and I was definitely several months, actually close to a year early on that call, so I'll take my lumps for that one, but I think it's finally upon us. There could be a pause if we really get the recession in earnest that a lot of people are expecting, but I don't think even in that case that it will last too long before we get to a supply constrained market, which is where I think we're headed. And so I'm delighted to be releasing my docuseries this week because I talk in episode 3 quite a bit about the reasons I think we're headed toward a global energy crisis before this decade is out.
Yeah, on page 2, I have that chart of crude oil, and it just continues to stay in a beautiful new uptrend. That pullback that we had here in August was a perfect buy on dip, testing that 50-day moving average, and now breaking out a whole series of highs. We're just approaching now the 2022 highs from the third and fourth quarter in kind of mid-90s range. And so the question here is that going to have oil bump its head there? I think it does inevitably. We are overdue for just a little swing trade correction on the downside of oil. But at this moment, this chart is very bullish and old dips should probably be bought. We'll see whether or not we can get up to the $100 level this year. All right, Eric, though, let's move on to equities. And on page 3, I have the chart of the S&P 500. What are you thinking here on the markets?
The longer this market holds up, the less likely it is that our many macro bear guests will be proven right on their calls that the bottom isn't yet in on this bear market. Now, I'm still swayed by their macro arguments, but unless this market rolls over and rolls over pretty darn soon, I think it's time to face the facts that the market, the chart is telling us that all of us bears just got the call wrong somehow. The recession that we all expected either didn't happen or it wasn't as deep as we expected or something. I don't know what else to say. I still think that the bearish arguments are very well composed and make lots of sense, but it's not what the chart's telling me is happening in this market.
Eric, my opinion differs slightly from yours because it generally, and more often than not, markets go through topping formations rather than just create a V-top and just start selling in a violent decline. I mean, it did happen in March 2020, but it is not the more common thing. And so in this scenario, markets often retest highs, whether double tops or even create all sorts of topping formations like a head and shoulders where we temporarily could break to a higher high. It reminds me a lot of 2007, where in spite of the very ugly summer of 2007, the market still managed to make a higher high in October of 2007 before the real bear market began. And so overall, even if this market did muster up a breakout on the upside in as we get through all this huge economic data releases, I think that the old rallies would be short-lived and it's going to be much more of a bigger topping formation than anything else. Let's move on, though, to the dollar index. What are you thinking here?
Well, the jury is still out. I'm glad to see it didn't break over 105 to the upside, but this chart still looks strong and an upside breakout isn't at all out of the question. So I'm in wait and see mode.
Eric, we continue to trade right along those 2023 highs. This is, I think, a huge overhead resistance. It's very simple in my mind. Dollar rallying, dollar strength is typically associated with weakness in risk assets and or vulnerability in them. And whether or not the dollar finds resistance here and consolidates is a big tell of whether or not risk assets can have another strong impulse. If for whatever reason, dollar strength persists, and particularly breaking to a fresh new year high, I think that would be a warning sign to risk assets and shouldn't be ignored. Nonetheless, let's move on to that gold chart on page five. What are you thinking here?
1926, the 200-day moving average on the continuation chart, is critical support on the gold chart, and it was just a few dollars below the market as of Wednesday's close. If it doesn't hold, a deeper correction is entirely possible, and that would fit my general outlook that inflation is likely to persist, the Fed is likely to hike rates higher and longer than most market participants expect. If 1926 does hold, and particularly if the Dixie reverses lower as well, well, it's possible that the bottom of this correction is already in. But frankly, I doubt it. My base case is that the Fed will hike rates longer and higher than most people thought possible, and then they'll eventually give up, and at that point, gold's going to go to the moon. But I think that's a 2024 story at this point, probably not a 2023 story, but a geopolitical escalation would be the caveat that could turn that around to the upside. So there's lots of levers to consider here, but one way or another, I think in 2024, if not sooner, we're going to move to new all-time highs.
Yeah, the only issue I have with gold right now is that it truly continues to just simply behave as a cross currency to the US dollar. I know it's rate sensitive, but you can't deny this inverse correlation. And right now, what we're seeing is the US dollar strong and almost all cross currencies continue to be weak and sluggish. I think that that correlation will dominate. And I feel that the next really strong period of gold, very similar to your view, is going to come when we have an easing cycle maybe next year and the Fed has to pivot and go the other direction. But until then, gold is a very weak chart in a downtrend, and it would not shock me if we had still more weakness to come on the very short term. In the bigger picture, though, I'll agree, that will all come to a big buying opportunity. It's just all about the timing of it right here. Moving on, though, I wanted to just touch on a couple more charts here, Eric. The first thing I wanted to touch on is this chart of the seasonality of market volatility from equityclock.com. And what was interesting here is that we are right now in mid-September entering a period where historically the next few months end up being very volatile. And that's often many people can recognize that typically September, October housed many previous market drops. And what's interesting is that we're in a period now, though, as Harley alluded to, where volatility premiums are very low and cheap, and you could buy hedges at historically low levels. And to just kind of reflect on that, on page seven, I have the VIX chart, which continues to trade at multi-year lows. You have, though, on page eight, the crude oil volatility index. And this is what I find amazing is that we're trading right now as well at multi-year lows on oil volatility. So even though oil's having this great rip to the upside, the optionality is very cheap to continue to trade and put bullish positioning on the upside that way. And similarly, on page nine, we have the gold volatility index as well at multi-year lows. And so it is so cheap to hedge here and to bet on long volatility, whether it's hedging or whether you want to just play long vols through straddling these different markets. The volatility and the Vega upside is definitely looking like it's asymmetrically skewed on the upside. Finally, I wanted to just touch on page 10 here, the high yield bond ETF. I know Harley was referencing all these credit spreads and so on. So on page 10, he's showing just a trade range of the high yield bonds, which is surprising to me considering every other bond market has been in a clear downtrend. Similarly, though, on page 11 is that chart that Harley was referring to in terms of the option adjusted credit spreads, also at a year low. But yet on page 12, I found this chart on the internet, which is showing the U.S. non-financial corporate net interest costs that being at their lowest in 60 years. But what it's interesting about is when it overlaid with the Fed funds rate, it's trying to show that typically the uptick or the turn up in these interest costs tend to be associated in with a substantial lag against the Fed funds. And so usually the Fed has already done its rate hike cycle by the time we start seeing an uptick in this. And this is the interesting part, is that whether or not there's one more rate hike coming in November or not, we are probably much closer to the end of the rate hike cycle than we were to the beginning. And inevitably, when the Fed will be forced to pause raising rates, the question is, what is going to be the lag time before we see these interest rate costs come? And it's either going to come with stresses on corporate profits, and eventually, as all of these shorter dated junk bonds need to be rolled, they're going to have to be financed at higher and higher rates. And this will trickle in inevitably. And question now is this going to be a 2024 story?
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, Harley Bassman's slide deck, and the chart book that we just discussed here in the post game, including a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelt with a K. And you can also follow me at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.